My guest today is bassist-composer Ron Carter. He's one of the most original, prolific, and influential players on the jazz scene. In fact, he's the epitome of class and elegance. How are you?
I'm doing great. After the introduction, I have to say I'm doing okay.
Well, you've always been doing okay, as far as I know.
Thank you.
I was trying to remember. I did remember, in fact, the first time we played together was in Connecticut years ago, and I think it was at the university somewhere.
Yes, on one of the early jazz festivals up there, I think.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I was sort of beginning, and I was kind of shy of you. Don't laugh, it's true.
Wow.
I was. Anyway, back to you, and how did you get started? I read where you started as a kid on cello.
Yeah, when I was 10 years old, back then, they had music in the public schools. And
they did.
Oh, yes. That was way before television. Yeah.
Well.
And she did it. The orchestra director brought in an array of instruments, and she said, okay, now here are these instruments for you. Whatever you pick, you're going to have to learn how to play it. And the cello just seemed to be the right sound at the time for me, given what was available, you know. And so I played it for a while.
You didn't really know anything about it? I mean, you
No.
Okay.
First one I'd ever seen, other than maybe a picture in a magazine or in the music magazines at school. But no, I just thought that for as crude as the sound was that I was getting, it had to get better. You know.
But that's interesting that you stuck with it. You didn't just say, well, I don't really want to play this old instrument.
No.
Or I guess you had to do it.
Well, you know, when you have kids who are the same age who are interested in making music and you're 10 years old, it's like a clubhouse.
Yeah.
You know, we never saw it as a chore or something that we really didn't want to do, but we were kind of stuck with it. We all saw it as another way to have fun and making music, you know.
Was this when you were living in Ferndale,
yeah,
Michigan?
Yeah. And then when I got to high school, Cass Tech.
I know that school.
Yeah. The school would kind of have small events, and they would hire kids from the orchestra to play these PTA events or music conventions, stuff like that. And I thought that I wasn't getting my share of those kinds of calls as a cello player. And I looked around, and there was no bass player. He just graduated. So I said, okay, if I play the bass, then they'll have to call me for these jobs. So I switched to bass January of 1955.
Oh, my goodness.
And came to New York August of 1959.
But you got a degree, I think I read.
I got a bachelor's in music.
From
Eastman.
Eastman.
Mm-hmm. And I came to New York 59 of August, and joined Chico Hamilton's band with Eric Dolphy in it for 4 months or so. And then Chico moved back to California to spend more time there, and Eric moved to New York to spend more time in New York.
So there went your group?
Yeah, but I enrolled in Manhattan School of Music for a master's and got a degree in 1961. And I decided that
Swinging.
I tried to make it work. So I played with Randy Weston for about a year. And
well, about, let's see, time. I'm trying to figure how old you were then. You were in your 20s?
23, something like that.
Boy.
Yeah. Just a spring chicken in New York.
Right. Well, why don't we play a tune?
Okay.
You've got another record called Stardust.
Yes, with Benny Golson on tenor, Joe Locke on vibes, Sir Roland Hanna on piano.
Sad about him.
Yes, yes. Lenny White on drums and myself. Several Oscar Pettiford for tunes on this record. One of my favorite songs of his is what I call his signature tune, which is Stardust. And when you hear this record that we did, at the last track of the record, and after the last note I play, it dies out, Roland Hanna says, yeah. And that makes it all worthwhile for me.
I heard that.
Yeah, that's great, yeah. So let's try Stardust and see what we can get going with this.
Can we do the verse?
Sure.
All right.
In D-flat.
In D-flat?
Yeah.
That's the, all right. Let's have at it. Thank you. see, we're getting to the point where you went with Miles. That must have been a big deal.
Well, you know, at the time, in 1963, that was the band to join. Everybody wanted to join the band.
It's funny, you went there and I went with Benny Goodman. I can tell you about that.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
I don't want to talk about that today, but
yeah, okay.
Marking dates.
Okay. I was working with Art Farmer at the Half Note down at Spring and Hudson, you know.
Oh, I love that room.
Nice room. I saw Train and Al and Cohen and Zoot Sims. Some great bands played there.
Yeah, they did.
And I was working with Art Farmer and Jim Hall and I think Walter Perkins. I had 2 weeks down there. And Miles came in the second night of the first week and called me over and said he was reforming the band, that Jimmy Cobb and Paul and Wendy had decided to leave to form a trio with Wes Montgomery. And he was going to California the next week and he wanted me to join the band. So I explained to him, Mr. Davis, you know, not Miles, Mr. Davis.
You said Mr. Davis?
Yeah. I'm working with Art Farmer for the next 2 weeks. So if you will ask Art Farmer to let me out of this week and the next week, I'm happy to go with you. But if Art feels that my presence is more needed on his gig than on your gig, then I'm happy to stay with Art. So after the next set, he and Art went to the corner, and Art decided it was okay for me to leave the band to go to join Miles for this 6-week West Coast tour. And that's how it started.
You must have been thrilled, or were you?
Well, I was a couple of things. First of all, I was really intent on showing Art Farmer my respect for him.
Yeah.
You know, that seemed to me at the time very important to do.
Yes, you know? Right.
And while Miles had the gig that everyone aspired to, so there's an order of courtesy that's necessary.
Oh, that's true.
You know, and once I got over that.
Well, he was evidently a good sport about it.
Yeah, yeah. It dawned on me that I'm playing with a band that everybody wants to be a part of. You know, and the band at that time was Harold Strozier on alto saxophone.
Who?
Harold Strozier. The first band that went out from New York in March of 63 was a sextet.
Yeah.
Jimmy Cobb stayed on drums to finish out his part of the tour. Miles. Harold Mabern played piano.
Oh, yeah.
George Coleman played tenor. Frank Strozier played alto, and I was a bass player for the 6-week West Coast tour.
Wow.
And after the tour was finished, Harold and Jimmy Cobb and Frank came back to New York, Frank Strozier, and Miles hired Victor Feldman, pianist, and
yes.
Frank Butler to do the first half of their first new quintet record, Seven Steps to Heaven.
Nice record.
Yeah, yeah. Nice sound, too.
Great. He was in, I don't know, just thinking about how he went from one kind of playing to another. That was a particular kind of playing of his that I really liked.
Mm-hmm.
And that was how you really got your feet wet with Miles. And
yes. Yeah. At the time, everyone was playing his library. I mean, everybody knew the intro to Bye-Bye Blackbird. All the piano players had to play that, you know. And
oh, sure.
Everybody had to play the stops behind the saxophone solo that they played on Milestones. I mean, we all knew the Miles library. And to be asked to join that environment was quite a treat.
I can imagine.
Gives me chills right now.
Well, I'm just trying to think how much later on that was when he came out with Kind of Blue.
Well, Kind of Blue was officially like 59, I think. The record was issued then.
You went with that band?
No, I went with the band subsequent to that with Herbie Hancock and Tony Williams and Wayne Shorter.
That's where you went?
Yeah, after the band came back to New York.
You just went with one big group and another, didn't you?
Tom, just give me the ticket, and I'll meet you at the airport. We can do this.
You must have been getting pretty used to all these great people calling you up.
Well,
Did you ever get nervous or think, gee, maybe I can't make this?
No. I never felt that I didn't belong there.
That's great.
No, I thought that if whoever calls me feels that I can help their project, then I belong there. I never felt that I was in over my head. And I'm 6'4", so it's a little difficult. In any event.
If you're going to get physical about it, I wouldn't want to get in a scuffle with you, that's for sure. No.
I never felt that I didn't belong there. I felt that I had practiced, I had earned my way, I had studied, I had played with wonderful players who I was able to learn from and add their knowledge to my growing base of information. And I felt comfortable to try to be able to deliver on the promise that they held for me.
I wish I could say I felt the same with Benny Goodman.
I heard some nice, not very nice things about him.
Well, we don't need to talk about that now, but some of them were funny. But I guess I did learn a lot from that. I went to the Menninger Psychiatric Institute after that.
Wow.
I always say Benny drove me there. It was a good thing. That's another show altogether.
Okay.
Anyway, we're sort of sliding towards another tune, aren't we?
Yeah. You know, I've been an Oscar Pettiford fan for a very long time, and it's nice to see that he's getting rediscovered through reissues and compendiums and repackaging of all his music from the late 50s up until his passing. So how about playing one of his songs he recorded? He called it Blues in the Closet. Bud Powell called it Black Eyed Peas and Collard Greens.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, but, a record he made with George DeVivier and Arthur Taylor. The record's called Glass Enclosure with Bud Powell. But let's play this one.
I remember
Blues in the
that.
Closet. Let's give it a shot. Let's see what happens.
Okay. The full Piano Jazz broadcast. Tune in next week to your NPR station. Log on to pianojazz.npr.org to find a station in your area. Piano Jazz is a production of South Carolina ETV and radio. Support for Piano Jazz comes from the Friends of Piano Jazz at NPR.